gentleman. Whose name is not in front of me. So we'll get to that when we get to that. And, okay. It's supposed to be here on the desktop. Oh, I guess I'll start with Amy Goodman while I sort that out. Oh, I guess I can play it direct from the prison radio website instead. Well, obviously I'm still sorting things out. Chaz Freeman was on the show I really like called Time of Useful Consciousness, TUC Radio, with Mariah Gallardin. Oh, I didn't say anything about my favorite triumvirate. I guess that's the wrong word. Those are three of my media heroes. Laura Flanders, I actually met many decades ago at a conference in, I believe it was Dublin. That's her native country. I think she had already been mainly living in the U.S. And as she mentioned here, she has a lot to report on here in the U.S. But I haven't played any of Sonali in a while. Yes Magazine has the Arun Gupta article on the lies about October 6th as regards some of the atrocities. There were atrocities occurred, but why they had to be amplified, I don't know, and lied about is a good question. To allow for the absolute genocidal rage that's going on right now, I guess. Jimmy Carter, I was heartened to see that Rolling Stone magazine actually put up a piece on Jimmy Carter and El Salvador. And let's see, what was the title of that again? It's about the way he did Jimmy Carter's dark legacy in El Salvador. Carter administration rejected Saint Oscar Romero. He was sainted afterwards, yeah. Pleas to not provide military aid to the murderous, treacherous Salvadoran regime. He delayed it for a little bit, but then continued it. In Guatemala, I think he cut it more permanently, but made sure, or maybe Zygmunt Brzezinski, made sure that there was continuity in weapons going there by using Israel. Some of that arming of Guatemala and El Salvador, the Central American Wars, was actually funded by Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia had a sub rosa. Jane Hunter has a book all about that, if you want to actually trust me but verify. And yeah, this article in Rolling Stone, just January 3rd, 2025, just published, written by Naomi LaChance. I don't know if she says that. Anyway, so I've got something on Carter. And then I was talking about Mariah Gallardin and got to thinking about the three women I was just hearing and got derailed again. I don't want to derail too much, so why don't we go to the James Earl Carter testimonial that Mumia Abu-Jamal has prepared. I'm sorry, I'm kind of low-functioning now.
James Earl Carter, 1924-2024. His name, James Earl Carter, Jr., was not a famous one, for few knew him by that name. But millions knew him by his nickname, his high-voltage smile, and his Georgia accent as Jimmy Carter, American president. Of all the modern presidents, he was perhaps the smartest, as he dabbled in nuclear physics and found his footing in politics after the scandal of Watergate as a political outsider. But in political terms, because he lost re-election, he was treated as a political leper. Carter, known as an avatar of human rights, lived a remarkable post-presidency, as much as did his wife, Rosalynn, who served the poor by building thousands of houses, treated chronic diseases in Africa, and monitored elections worldwide. His recent death, after 100 years of life, marked a truly remarkable life. His 1980 election loss to former actor Ronald Reagan also marked a turning point in American politics. Why? Carter lost in part because the Iranians took American hostages and held them until Reagan took office. Some political observers say high inflation was also a factor, but that wasn't the real reason. Carter lost principally because when he first ran for the presidency, he won some 75% of the white evangelical vote. When he ran for re-election, that number had fallen to around 25%, which meant a fall of some 50 points. No politician can survive such a plunge. Carter announced and aired his support for civil rights. White evangelicals fled in terror. Why? Because for them, Christianity meant whiteness, and segregation was in furtherance of whiteness. Think of recent evangelical support for Trump. Evangelicals equals whiteness. It did then, it does now. Seen in this light, black liberation amounts to anathema. A little lesson from history. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Well, I didn't see that coming. I would have had something to intro about it. Maybe I should write him tomorrow. Mumia Abu-Jamal. So indeed, I will go on and play this discourse about Carter and his neoliberal policies, basically. There's a podcast that was done 3 years ago now by a couple of guys, Scott Parkin and Robert Buscano, Green and Red Podcast, issues of leftism and environmentalism. They'll discuss policies of this presidency. I'm a little bit taken aback by their discussion of the foreign aspect, because they don't seem to know about Brzezinski's revelation. Still not commented much on in the U.S., but I thought some leftist press has pretty well covered the fact that the U.S. started arming the Mujahideen before the Russians came in. They seem to, at least if I heard it right, accept the line that it was in response to the Russians being invited in by the communist government in Kabul. But actually, they were Brzezinski's chessboard, and that's a word in one of his book titles. He set the Afghan trap for the Russians, wanted them to come in, and it did do a big number on their economy. As we know about fighting foreign wars, even with proxies, they don't do a terribly good job of that. I thought, if I heard it, maybe I misheard it, but it was quite at the end of this rather long piece, hour and 9 minutes, so I'll be excerpting it. I haven't quite decided. I do want to get some of Chaz Freeman on. He's an ambassador during, I don't know, maybe it was during Carter's time. There were some interesting folks in his administration. Actually, his CIA had wanted to reform the CIA, if I recall. And we know that he was a much better ex-president. This is how the two people in the podcast are going to... Since being president, Carter has been a genuinely decent human, a diplomat and a humanitarian. But as president, he carried water for the ruling class, both at home and abroad. I didn't know that he and Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski founded the Trilateral Commission. It's discussed here. They also give the impression the Trilateral Commission is kind of this outside group. I didn't know Carter was a founding member of it. And you don't learn that from this as well. This hasn't been widely viewed. greenandredpodcast.org. And like I say, it's about 3 years old. It's got no thumbs down on it. So opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others, but actually I did all the induction on that and forgot that I've got Amy Goodman queued up, and that's one of my regular features. And she's got her holiday edition about Oz. I haven't seen the film. Excuse me, I don't see many first-run films. I did see The Conclave. I didn't watch it four or five times like my sister did. It's been a discussion item on our Zoom and probably will in the future. I recommend it highly. It's got some stars that seem kind of like, or this guy really wants to portray a cardinal. But it does bring star power, and maybe some people who aren't Catholics are interested in watching the Pope being picked. It has some twists and turns in it that are quite amazing. I'm not a film person. I don't even know how to watch films well anymore. So, yeah. Let's see. Here's Amy's breaking the sound barrier. And then we'll get to Carter's legacy. We'll hear mostly the stuff about the domestic policy. Deregulation, setting the stage for Reagan to do it up Republican style. He was doing it neoliberal Democratic style.
Yip Harburg. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. People around the globe have been watching the blockbuster musical film Wicked this holiday season. Based on the Broadway musical, it serves as a backstory to the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz, casting that film's villain, the Wicked Witch of the West, in a positive light as a misunderstood and bullied child who goes on to challenge authority and expose wrongdoing. From the mid-1950s until the early 1990s, long before streaming platforms and video on demand, television audiences dependent on just a few major broadcast networks had to wait for the annual chance to see The Wizard of Oz. The much-anticipated special broadcast would typically air between Thanksgiving and Christmas, attracting millions of viewers across the country. This shared cinematic tradition popularized the fantastic tale of Dorothy, her dog Toto, and the Scarecrow, Tin Man, and Lion. The film also brought global acclaim to its musical score with iconic songs like Follow the Yellow Brick Road. And We're Off to See the Wizard. Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead.
Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. Witch, oh, witch, the witch, the witch.
And the world-renowned classic, Over the Rainbow. Less well-known is the writer of the lyrics to those songs, E.Y. Yip Harburg. In an era of rising authoritarianism, growing inequality, and an ascendant billionaire class, Yip Harburg's socially conscious songs and his own struggle to overcome poverty during the Great Depression and then blacklisting during the McCarthy era, even as The Wizard of Oz gained fame, serve as both an inspiration and a warning. Yip Harburg was born in 1896 in Manhattan's Lower East Side to poor Jewish parents who fled the anti-Semitic pogroms of Eastern Europe along with so many others. In high school, he was seated alphabetically next to Ira Gershwin. They began a friendship that lasted a lifetime and shaped 20th century American song and culture. Ernie Harburg, Yip's son and co-author of the biography, Who Put the Rainbow in the Wizard of Oz, said in a 1996 interview on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
Yip knew poverty deeply, and he quoted Bernard Shaw as saying that the chill of poverty never leaves your bones. And it was the basis of Yip's understanding of life as struggle.
Yip Harburg was deep in debt after the 1929 Wall Street crash. Gershwin suggested Harburg write song lyrics. Before long, he wrote the song that captured the essence of the Great Depression, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?, which became a national hit and remains a timeless anthem for hard times, corporate greed, and the dignity of working people.
Once I built a railroad, made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
The Wizard of Oz was based on the 1900 novel The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum. Prior to the commercial success Baum enjoyed from the book, he worked an array of jobs, including a stint in South Dakota owning the Aberdeen Saturday Pioneer newspaper from 1890 to 91. There, he wrote editorials, including two that called for genocide against indigenous people. Just days after the Wounded Knee Massacre of December 29, 1890, in which an estimated 300 Lakota elders, women, and children on the nearby Pine Ridge Reservation were slaughtered by the U.S. Army, Baum wrote, quote, "Our only safety depends upon the total extermination of the Indians. Wipe these untamed and untamable creatures from the face of the earth," unquote. Yip Harburg's writing, conversely, dignified the downtrodden, the working class, immigrants, and other marginalized groups. These themes were central to the two Broadway hits Yip wrote, Bloomer Girl, about the women's suffrage movement, and Finian's Rainbow, which celebrated immigrants and the struggle against racism. His lyrics attracted the attention of the House Un-American Activities Committee and U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy, who led a deeply destructive hunt for communists within the government and leading institutions, including Hollywood studios. McCarthy was aided by the red-baiting lawyer Roy Cohen, who would later serve as mentor to a young Donald Trump. Yip Harburg was among hundreds of writers, actors, and others banned from working in film and television for the duration of the 1950s. McCarthy and his anti-communist crusade were eventually discredited, and Harburg continued his creative human rights work until his death in 1981, aged 84. Yip Harburg's best-known and most loved work remains his lyrics for The Wizard of Oz. The film was released in the tumultuous year of 1939. Fascism was on the march in Europe and Asia. The economic impacts of the Depression still plague the working class, and racist Jim Crow laws oppress millions of people of color. With just weeks from Donald Trump's inauguration to his second term as president, and with a timely focus on challenging authority ushered in by the hit movie Wicked, now is a good time to recall the incredible work and lyrical lessons of Yip Harburg, the man who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, Amy's a big Sundance enthusiast. I think she goes mostly for the documentaries. That's coming up. I'm distracted by that because the film about Assange was pulled from the schedule because they said they found a whole wealth of new material that they had to use. So it's back in production as opposed to post-production, getting ready to be filmed at the end of the month. Screened, I mean. Okay, I'm way behind. I don't know what I'll get on. I'll be excerpting these two pieces again. greenandredpodcasts.org for the entirety of this. I gave some disclaimers about some of the material in it, or their analysis. I should write them too. This is 3 years old, but timely on Carter. Again, I've been scanning the Rolling Stone article, and it is pretty damning about the famous plea from Romero to Carter to stop the funding of the weaponry, and then he was shot while giving a sermon, canonized later. The other piece will be some from Chaz Freeman. Some of this was already aired. It was cut to a half hour by Mariah Gallardin for the Thursday broadcast of TUC Radio, but it's actually from an hour-long segment, so I'll be looking. Maybe I'll be playing some more of that tomorrow, particularly because I'm not sure how much I'll get on today. But let's get started with Liberal Saint Now, Neoliberal War Criminal Then, James Earl Carter.
We have talked about a long time, and on my blog, afflictthecomfortable.org, which is part of the Green and Red Media Empire, I wrote a piece in November, on the spur of the moment, about Jimmy Carter. And I think it was called, let's say right here, Jimmy Carter is a liberal saint now, was a war criminal then. And I do not get the traffic of Jacobin or any of those big New York publications, obviously. But for some reason, this thing is like really taken off. And I'm still getting, like, every week, I'm still getting like hundreds of reads. I have no idea why. And we've talked about doing a show about this for some time, about Jimmy Carter. And so the recent death of his vice president, Walter Mondale, kind of became the impetus to actually do it. And the reason I think Carter is important, one, because I think it's just historically, it's always important to understand what people really were like and what they really did. But we're going to say a lot of negative stuff about Jimmy Carter, right? Jimmy Carter is lionized, and he should be. I don't want you to think, you know, I mean, his work with Habitat for Humanity, the Carter Center working on elections all over the world, his views on race, his outspoken views on race. He won a Nobel Prize for working on the North Korea nuclear agreement in the 90s. On Israel, he's remarkable. He has used the word apartheid in a book title to describe Israel's treatment of Palestinians. So he's a great guy. And I think that's the point, because people like that don't become president if they're people like that, right? Most of the time, all the time, to get to that level of power in the government, whether it be president, Senate, courts, whatever, you fit into this super framework of what the oligarchy wants. And only rarely does somebody move beyond that. And we're seeing that now, right? All these people like Boehner, John Boehner, oh, I hate Trump. And I voted for him, right? And you're seeing people who are criticizing Trump and not really distancing themselves. That's why like Liz Cheney has become Trump's biggest critic in this upside down world we have. But rarely does a member who was at that level, and I can think of a few, one, and we'll talk about him in a future show, is Ramsey Clark, who was the Attorney General. Ramsey Clark's father was Tom Clark, who was a Supreme Court Justice, who, if he didn't write the decision, certainly voted for the putting Japanese in concentration camps in World War II. Ramsey Clark was Attorney General and later became a huge advocate for non-intervention, anti-imperialism, and civil rights. Before Carter, the best known, I would say, would probably be George Kennan, who was one of the architects of the Cold War, famous diplomat, who later in life became like this ardent critic of nuclear weapons, nuclear proliferation. And in the 1980s, wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs, which is the official, publication of the ruling class, in which he said his concern for the future wasn't nuclear war, it was some kind of catastrophic environmental event. This is in the early 1980s. So, and you know, he really became, it almost sounded like the new left people we've read. And then there's Jimmy Carter. And so that's what we want to talk about. He's done great stuff, but what we're going to do is tell you like how he became president and what he did as president and how American politics is structured in a way that a good guy is never going to become president and never going to get close to that. You saw Bernie Sanders, right? Who, you know, what we're seeing now from Biden is that you know, Sanders and Warren aren't really all that different from a lot of the stuff we're seeing, other than Medicare for All, which would be pretty radical. What Biden's doing isn't all that dissimilar to what Warren and Sanders were talking about. So Jimmy Carter, as president, really fit well into that framework and laid the groundwork for Reagan, for Clinton, for this really pretty significant rightward drift that we've been seeing since the 60s and 70s, right? So I think Scott wants to lead off to talk a little bit about, well, we're going to start by talking about who Jimmy Carter was and how he became president. And that involves the story of a group called the Trilateral Commission. So,
yep. And the Trilateral Commission is a term that you hear often in these conspiracy circles. You hear about the Rockefellers and you hear about the Freemasons and you hear about the Illuminati, and the Trilateral Commission is often
the Stonecutters.
Exactly. And the Trilateral Commission is actually now equated to some grand globalist conspiracy, et cetera. But the important thing about the Trilateral Commission is it actually was a very influential body. It was a nonpartisan, non-governmental discussion group founded by David Rockefeller in 1973. And it was created to foster closer cooperation between Japan, Western Europe, and North America. And I'm going to actually read a quote. I'm going to start with a quote by one of our favorite people, which is Noam Chomsky. And Noam says, talking about the Trilateral Commission and the philosophy of the Trilateral Commission is essentially liberal internationalists from Europe, Japan, and the United States, the liberal wing of the intellectual elite. That's where Jimmy Carter's whole government came from, the Trilateral Commission. The Trilateral Commission was concerned with trying to induce what they called more moderation in democracy, little d democracy. Turn people back to to being passive and obedience, so they don't put so many constraints on state power and so on. In particular, they were worried about young people. They were concerned about the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, that's their phrase, meaning schools, universities, church, and so on. They're not doing their job. The young are not being sufficiently indoctrinated. They're too free to pursue their own initiatives and concerns, and you've got to control them better. And so like I said, the Trilateral Commission comes together in 1973. It is a group of private citizens from the elite circles, includes David Rockefeller, Brzezinski, Cyrus Vance. If you look at it in the spectrum of American politics, it's people from both parties, including William Scranton, who was a liberal Republican from Pennsylvania. He was a governor. And so essentially, when we talk about, and Bob and I actually met in the midst of an anti-corporate globalization movement about 20 years ago. There's a lot of critique of this phrase, which we actually need to do a show on, called neoliberalism. And so what the Trilateral Commission did was it's one of those bodies which essentially managed the framework that led to this neoliberalism that rose up through the what we tend to think has happened during the Reagan years, but it actually happened during the Carter years. And that's a little bit about what we're going to talk about.
Yeah. But
it was a very influential body on governments, and it was a very influential body on the US government. And it started with the administration of Jimmy Carter.
And Jimmy Carter, who was a peanut farmer, ran for governor of Georgia in 1974. He'd been in the state legislature, was elected governor, was a member of the Trilateral Commission. And some of those names there you mentioned, Zbigniew Brzezinski was the kind of director of the Trilateral Commission, became his version of Henry Kissinger, Cyrus Vance, I believe Griffin Bell may have been in it.
Brzezinski worked for Kissinger, correct?
Yeah, I think he did, yeah. But he always thought he was smart, you know, he's not saying much. But Brzezinski later in life actually became kind of a critical of like wars in the Middle East and things like that. But at any rate, and Carter was a member of this. And like you said, it's not a conspiracy. This is done in the open. I mean, they're having open meetings. Everybody knows about it. It's being covered in the media. Around that same time, there was another group called the Committee on the Present Danger, which was established to push for higher defense spending. So we should do a show about all this, because the left loves these conspiracies that they're not. They're just a bunch of people. And Jimmy Carter, like, you know, impressed these people at the Trilateral Commission. You know, at the time, he's really young. He's fresh. This is Watergate. It just happened 2 years earlier. He was kind of unknown, and then he's the first person who really understood that the Iowa caucuses could be important, you know, so he spent a lot of time in Iowa and won the caucuses, and all of a sudden, you know, the Democrats were in disarray after 1972 and after Watergate, so kind of the usual suspects were running. You had Ed Muskie was allegedly the front runner, and he kind of fell apart, and I think, did McGovern run again? I can't remember now. And
McGovern seemed to be perpetually running.
There were 10 or 12 people. Fred Harris from Oklahoma, who was actually a good old populist.
Jerry Brown, Scoop Jackson.
Fred Harris had the best line. He said, the little people are going to elect me president. And like after two primaries, he dropped out. He said, the little people were too small to reach the voting levers. So, but, and Jimmy Carter emerged from that. And the ruling class loved him, right? Because, you know, in the aftermath of Watergate, there was this intense anger. And there was a real fear. Like Chomsky's quote says, like, the 60s scared the hell out of these people. Right? The students are on campus and SDS and, you know, Black Panthers. And so they want to bring back this level of normalcy. And Carter is their guy, right? And, you know, as you said, you know, he kind of lays the groundwork. What, like his views on race, right, which are ironic, right? Because he's great. I mean, he's working with Stacey Abrams. He's been very outspoken on all racial issues, on police and everything. But That wasn't Jimmy Carter in 1976, was it?
No. And it's interesting. One thing I'm going to say to kind of prelude all of this is that a lot of what we attribute to Reagan, like policies and bringing in certain political views and things like that, a lot of it started with Carter. And so, for example, in 1976, when he was running for president, he's really known actually for what I believe he said when he launched his campaign, which was to be contrary to Nixon, which is like, I will never lie to you. But there's a lot of other interesting things he says in that campaign. And so, you know, Carter actually race baited during the 1976 election. So by the mid 70s, there had actually been a big push on busing, particularly in northern cities, but also in places like Charlotte. And so Carter came out and spoke out against that. And he was doing that during the 1976 primary and election to appeal to Northern white ethnics and white Southerners. And he carried a majority of white Southern men in 1976 in the election, in the general election. But a quote that he said was, I see nothing wrong with ethnic purity being maintained. I would not force a racial integration of a neighborhood by government action. And then a couple late days later, when he was criticized for it by the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, he doubled down and he said, what I say is that the government ought not to take as a major purpose the intrusion of alien groups into a neighborhood simply to establish their intrusion. And so
that's not really even coded language.
No.
And he and Jesse Jackson got into a very public pitch.
And it's you know, a lot of when Reagan announced his presidential run in, I believe, 1979, he did it at the Mississippi State Fairgrounds. In blanking on the town in Mississippi, but it's, you know, near where the three civil rights workers were murdered in 1964. A lot of coded language in there about states' rights, blah, 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 et cetera. Carter predates that. Carter
also reached out to the evangelical community.
Philadelphia, Mississippi. That's where it
was. Carter also reached out to the evangelical religious community.
Yep.
And I believe met with Jerry Falwell. And
yep.
I think kind of got his blessing. Carter won a majority of evangelical votes. So today, when we talk about, you know, the horrors of these evangelicals and Trump, Carter started that.
Yeah, exactly. And the rise of the religious right didn't start with, they joined the Republican coalition, the Reagan coalition, the Republican coalition in 1980, but they were actually part of the Carter coalition in 1976 to get him elected and to beat Ford, who was actually a bit of a liberal Republican, just to be clear.
Yeah, you know, in retrospect, as you look back on these things, like I was saying the other day, like, you know, it might have been better for everybody if Mitt Romney had won in 2012. And Ford, yeah, I mean, you know, Jerry Ford, let me kind of, I roam around, but I remember, and I've said this, I've told you this story like probably more times you care to remember. Jerry Ford, I believe it was his first press conference, either as president or right after the pardon. And they talked about the pardon. And then somebody said there was a bill, a public spending bill, like a small amount, $15 billion or something like that. And they asked Jerry Ford about it. And he said, look, you know, we're in an economic, you know, we're in a stagnant economy. The federal government has a responsibility, an obligation to take care of people in times like this. I mean, can you imagine anybody, any Democrat from that point on, Clinton or Gore, or, you know, Biden's actually saying that now, which is kind of why we've talked about, we're starting to see kind of some, you know, slight reversion back to these kind of corporate liberal ideas because the situation is so bad. But no, absolutely. Ford, in retrospect, when you look back, yeah, we might have been better off if he'd beaten Jimmy Carter, given the nature of what's happened since then.
Yeah, exactly. On the other domestic front that we wanted to touch on is around economic policy. And so Carter was very much a fiscal conservative, probably a physical conservative as well, but we won't go.
Well,
there.
He did give an interview.
Okay, I'm cutting in. They get a little profane a little bit here. I did that on the argument that Carter had with Jackson. But I don't know if I really accept these analysis. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers. This is again from greenandredpodcast.org. Buscano, with that great name of a website, has been inactive for the last year. He did a whole series on JFK. So
that effectively wants to foster lower taxes, decrease in regulation, and free trade, right? And so everything that we have organized against just since Seattle, the WTO protests in Seattle, is essentially like supply-side economics, and it's the governing philosophy of Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and Trump.
And Carter had a kind of sketchy relationship, sometimes antagonistic relationship, with the union, with labor, because of that. Supply side means you take care of, you know, you have supply and demand. Supply are the producers, demand are the consumers, right?
Right.
And basic Keynesian economics is basically demand side, which means, you know, the basis of Keynes' idea is that you provide employment, because employment gives people money and then they can become consumers. Supply side means you take care of the people at the top. Generally, it means you cut taxes. And then by doing that, you open that money for investment and you know, and that'll trickle down, right? So the unions still wanted good union contracts and they wanted good wages and they still were kind of living in that Keynesian economy. And Carter's really the first person. He had really antagonistic relationships with a lot of, especially left labor, like the mechanics, the machinist union at the time, and a couple others, you know, wanted Teddy Kennedy to run. Chappaquiddick had made that impossible, but the liberal wing of the Democratic Party wanted Teddy Kennedy to run. And so they never really warmed to Carter, and Carter didn't warm to them.
No. And we talk about the dismantling of the New Deal, even though all of these politicians run on how, you know, an embrace of the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt, like Carter and Reagan, yeah, and say that, you know, Reagan's noted for saying that FDR was one of his heroes as when he was a young man. But they're actually the ones who began the dismantling of the regulatory systems that the New Deal policies had implemented. Reagan actually praised Carter in a column. One of the ways that Reagan, after he was governor of California, he had a radio show, which would probably be a podcast in 2021, and then a column. And he actually had a column called "Give Carter a Chance," praising his fiscal conservatism. But Carter
and worth noting, in this 1976 election, Carter had been way ahead, like by 20 points, and barely won, eked it out.
Right.
But the Democrats that year had, you know, a veto-proof Congress. Because of Watergate, they had 2/3 of the Senate and the House. And I don't know, I think FDR is the only other time that it happened.
Right.
So he had incredible political juice, much like Obama did in 2009.
Yep.
And he essentially went to war against the liberal wing of his own party.
Yeah. And there were a number of things that he did that you know, pissed off the liberal wing of his party. Deregulation was actually a big one. There was moves around with the Interstate Commerce Commission to deregulate trucking and railroads. There was a deregulation move against Ma Bell, the phone companies. And then there was also deregulation moves around the oil sector as well.
And airlines
as well.
In 1980, Reagan, there were, I think, something like 29 domestic carriers. And within like, a decade and a half, it was down to, when you were working in your old corporate life, what was there, like 5 or 6 major carriers?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But then we also had the rise of the low-cost carriers. This is like mid to late 90s, which were like really challenging.
He deregulated trucking, which meant, which really hurt wages among truckers.
And put him at odds with the Teamsters.
With the Teamsters Union, right. And the Teamsters, I think, didn't the Teamsters endorse Reagan in 1980?
Yes, they did.
They might have, yeah.
Yeah, they did. One thing I want to say about the oil sector is, you know, there were a couple different schools of thought here. Is like, you know, Ted Kennedy, who was becoming the leader of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, was essentially advocating nationalization of the oil industry, where Reagan was calling for complete deregulation. And so Carter took a middle road. And we, in prepping for this episode, Bob found an article in Mises by some unknown academic who I don't remember his name.
Ludwig von Mises was one of the Austrian economists, you know, hardcore conservative libertarian, no regulation, no laws, basically. So the Mises Institute is kind of as far out there as you can get.
Take us back to feudalism.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is, you know, Milton Friedman and then Hayek and all those guys, right? The Austrians, right?
Yeah.
They are the sworn mortal enemies of the Keynesians, right? And, yeah, I'm looking around and I find this article from some guy in the Mises Institute newsletter praising Jimmy Carter.
The title of the article is Rethinking Carter, but there's a great quote in it. Do you want to read that?
Yeah. The last line here. And he basically praises him for all the reasons we just gave, deregulation and limiting spending on infrastructure and things like that. Like the infrastructure bill today, that was an issue in the late 1970s, spending on infrastructure. So you can imagine like a lot of that stuff we're talking about today hasn't been touched, bridges and roads. And now we have, you know, internet and things like that. What the one line you had, Scott always prepares notes for this. He does all the heavy lifting. But at the time, Ma Bell, a copper wire could carry 15 calls. And today, a single fiber optic line can carry 2 million calls. So that's the kind of infrastructure we were talking about at the time. But the last line in this article in the Von Mises Institute newsletter is, however, Carter actually made it easier for Reagan to take the actions he did. If the Democrats wish to lionize one of their own as the creator of the new economy, they should be looking at Jimmy Carter, not Bill Clinton. And other than you and I, and you know, some lefty economists and historians, people like Noam Chomsky, I've never heard anybody say that. So we are on the same side as the Austrians on this one.
I've aspired to that for a long time.
So. I know, right?
and so it's really important. Like thinking about this in terms of the Trilateral Commission, what they did, thinking about Carter's conservative economic politics. There was also, you know, the other thing I want to talk about real just touch on really quick, and Bob kind of touched on this, is there's two, the Democratic Party is very polarized in this moment. And so there's a pretty strong liberal wing, which is led by Ted Kennedy, George McGovern, people like that. And they're in deep conflict with this more conservative wing of the party, which is led by Carter. And so clearly Carter had won the primaries. He had been able to win the election by making a pre-Reagan coalition, Carter coalition. And this is also a story that it continues to play out. Today, you could see it as being more about the wing that's led by Rahm Emanuel and Obamaites versus the Sanders AOC wing, right? With Absolutely. Biden somewhere in the middle. And so it's in Ryan Grimm, who's a bureau chief, DC bureau chief for The Intercept, actually wrote a great book that came out just a couple of years ago called We've Got the People, or We Got People, which is essentially at least a 40-year history of this struggle. He starts also in 1980 about the struggle between the liberal left wing and the conservatives, mainstream establishment Democrats. But just very important thing to kind of think about the context. There, you know, we could also look at the Republicans and we can see the splits there as well. And that's actually playing out very publicly right now. But the context of what happens with the Democrats and their political divisions is very important.
And what that does with Carter is it moves, Carter and Reagan move everybody to the right. So that when we talk about centrist Democrats back in the early 1970s, those guys were like liberal Republicans, right?
Right, right.
So Carter is really pivotal. And you know, not that I'm a seer, because a lot of people were saying this in 2016, I said, no matter who wins, I think you're looking at a Jimmy Carter presidency, like a one term, you know, kind of really lackadaisical malaise. Who knew it would be so tumultuous? But the fact is, like, you know, we were right. But Carter's presidency is not looked on favorably. You know, he was at war with his own party. In fact, Teddy Kennedy ran in the primaries against him in 1980, which is really bad whenever you have a primary challenge. It's like when Pat Buchanan, remember, ran, you know, fairly strongly against George Bush in 92. You right. kind of knew George Bush was done for.
Or when Sanders ran pretty strongly against Hillary in 2016.
Yeah. Carter defeated Kennedy because he had the mechanism of the party behind him. But by that time, you had just the country, you know, you had these energy problems, and he was advocating kind of this, you know, he did these fireside chats, remember? And he talked about malaise and all that. Like, a lot of lefties liked him because he was friends with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson. Like, you know, he let Willie Nelson smoke weed at the White House and he would quote Dylan all the time, right? But the reality was that the country wasn't doing well. And then the big bomb came, I think, with regard to, and we can do this as a segue into the foreign policy stuff, which is what my article was actually about. The big bomb was Iran. It occurred in the Middle East. Iran had become America's, along with Israel and Saudi to some extent, but even more Iran. And we talked about this, remember, a few weeks ago, that really great show we did with Eskandar. And we have to do another show on Iran because the things aren't getting, you know, different there. Obviously, you just had this hack by Israel. Israel is trying to muck up any opportunity to create, and it's not like Biden's eager to do it anyway, but Israel's really mucking up every chance to kind of create any kind of stability in that region. But you have the revolution in Iran, you know, the Islamic revolution with Khomeini. Prior to that, under the Nixon years, the U.S. had established Iran as kind of a...
Well, I'm going to fade out there and go to the Middle East a little bit. Nothing particularly directly on Gaza. And they did at the beginning talk about how Carter actually had a book out called with apartheid in the title about the Middle East. And you can find a lot of criticisms from the Likud affiliated press of Carter. I keep bringing up the fact that the Camp David Accords is put up as one of his accomplishments, but nobody's talking about the fact that the border at Rafah between Egypt and Gaza is one of the things that was settled in the Camp David Accords, and that's one of the things that Israel wants, is to have control of the border, not have Egypt have control. It was actually joint control, but they want to have it all. So again, that was from Green and Red Podcast. Title of the article that one of the participants wrote a number of years ago: Jimmy Carter is a liberal saint now, was a war criminal then. Afflict the Comfortable is the name of the website. It's inactive for the last year or so. Another article at Chomsky.info, Noam Chomsky, the Carter Administration, Myth and Reality. And that article is at Chomsky.info, and it's from a book, one of the 100 books that Chomsky wrote. I didn't remember the title of it. I mentioned at the top of the show that Rolling Stone actually had the temerity to publish in the last day or so Jimmy Carter's Dark Legacy in El Salvador. Carter administration rejected Saint Oscar Romero's pleas not to provide military aid to the Salvadoran junta just before he was assassinated. Sad story there. All right. Now off to a fellow who I don't know much about. Chaz Freeman is his name. Interviewed by a guy that I don't know much about either. But we're going to see if I have this queued up. Radio Free Labor coming up. And I guess I'll play two underwriting announcements back to back because I spaced it out. So here's a segment from Ambassador Chaz Freeman, America's Problematic Policies. Interview on podcast by a Persian fellow, I'll call him, Nima Al-Kushurad. It's called Dialogue Works. I hope it does. And it's not on Apple Podcasts. It's a YouTube podcast only, apparently. Got a Ray McGovern that was a challenging listening for me. But Chaz Freeman, I know, is being quite good on China, trying to undercut the hawks that are on both sides, all sides. It's a very bipartisan, hawkish attitude we have, don't we? All right. Forgot who I've got the question queued up or not. We'll close out with this segment for the next 7 minutes, but you can find it. It's a really, really good interview, I thought. Covers a lot of issues. Oh, the guy that did Mouse apparently is collaborating on a graphic novel about Gaza, and it's going to be critical of Israeli policy. I haven't done anything about Gaza. I feel like we have to do something all the time because it's still such a amazing, horrific sight of suffering, and we're paying for it.
In the West Bank, the part of Gaza being left to the Palestinians, the Saudis will.
Well, let me turn off the green and red, folks. And sorry about that. Doing a different different broadcasting mechanism here, and hopefully this will work now.
But since they have all bases covered, you know, this is not Iran. If there were a revolution in Saudi Arabia, it would be led by one member of the family against the rest of the family. In fact, in some ways, Mohammed bin Salman has done that. So I think we're talking about a very different political animal than let's say, Syria with all of its divisions, or Iran with its heritage of Shiism.
Ambassador, it seems that in Ukraine right now, they're trying to, when you look at Donald Trump and his envoy Keith Kellogg, talking about the conflict in Ukraine or the Biden administration. Both of them are talking about putting Ukraine in a better position right now. They're sending a lot of weapons right now and aid to Ukraine. The question is, when the Ukrainian army is not capable to fight against Russia, who's going to fight that? Who's going to put Ukraine in a better position? Is that going to be European countries sending their troops or maybe mercenaries, new mercenaries to the conflict?
No, that is not going to happen. And Mr. Trump is quite clear that he does not want to send U.S. troops. In fact, the latest polling data in Europe shows a very strong reduction in support for sticking with Ukraine until it, quote, wins, unquote. There's rising support for a negotiated solution, which will inevitably have to be mostly on Russian terms. Furthermore, I don't know whether to believe this or not, but I just watched a clip in France from a French reporter in Kursk in the Ukrainian salient inside Russia. And what he describes is a disaster. And he predicts that Mr. Putin wants to liberate the Kursk region from Ukraine by New Year's, which is only a few days away. He says in his unit, 75% of the men have defected. Why? Because they are being asked to be cannon fodder. They are artillerymen and other specialties. They're being asked to charge defensive positions the Russians have set up as infantry. And this is suicide. So I would say, I don't know whether New Year's is feasible, since there's still quite a bit of territory held by the Ukrainian forces. I note that there's also a report now that at least one wounded North Korean has been captured by the Ukrainians. I feel sorry for him. But on the other hand, apparently the North Koreans don't take any prisoners. They shoot everybody, wounded or not. So this is a mess. And it's part of a broader pattern in which the Russians continue to advance across a broad front inside Ukraine. And nobody is in a position to stop them. This isn't about weapons, it's about manpower. And it's about willpower. The Ukrainians have shown enormous willpower. One has to greatly respect them for their bravery on the battlefield and the indomitable will they've brought to bear on it. But there are limits to what human beings can do, and they have reached them. So we are now hearing more and more talk about negotiations. And I note that Prime Minister Fico of Slovakia was just in Moscow and offered Slovakia as a venue for such negotiations. And Mr. Putin said that would be fine because Slovakia has adopted a neutral position. So I think the Russians are open to a negotiation. So far, the Ukrainians and the West are not, but time is running out.
And that's a dissident view from a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, Chaz Freeman, who was an ambassador to, I don't know what era he was in, maybe under the Carter administration. He snuck in past Zbigniew Brzezinski, who again was credited as being kind of anti-war at the end of his life. Well, he set the stage for it all by setting the Afghan trap, if you will. There are people that said that. Gus is having a fit over there. How can anybody say anything good about Brzezinski? I couldn't believe it either myself. Anyway, I'm going to play two underwriting announcements back to back because I've neglected to put it on. Sorry about that. You people that are waiting anxiously for Radio Free Labor, and it'll give me just enough time to maybe get the theme music set up. How about that? Got a full compliment today, so hang around.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at